So, stage is yours.
Thank you for being here. I'm very grateful and very honored by returning. That's the truth. I live in New York, born in New York City. I live near New York City in the United States. I've been researching UFOs for about 20 years. I say UFOs, but really I think what we study is a lot beyond UFOs. It's a lot beyond unidentified flying objects. That's one of the things I would like to talk to you about today. You know, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, when the world really became conscious of this phenomenon, people talked about the flying saucers in the sky, and that's what everyone noticed, and that's what everybody talked about. Or really close by here, the ghost rockets and other aerial objects. And it's certainly true that that's a very important part of what we study. But as the years and decades and generations have gone by, we realize that there's a lot more going on. So I've been thinking about UFOs in that capacity and trying to think of it in a more fresh way, in a little bit more of an original way. I don't think that I'm at the end of that process, but I'm certainly trying to work through it. Let me see if I can bring my computer up a little closer without disconnecting anything. Great. I'll just tell you briefly, I'm a historian by training. I don't really do a lot of UFO investigation, although I do some now. That's really not my main thing. My main focus is to understand this phenomenon. So I've spent a great deal of time researching historical documents, primarily American. And I've spent a great deal of time trying to piece together the history. I've written two volumes of history on this topic. There are two volumes known as UFOs and the National Security State. They're each fairly long. They're about 500 or 600 pages each. There'll be a third volume. So it'll be a three-volume history that will cover the whole modern phenomenon from the early 1940s, really through the Second World War, through today. Using archival resources, really trying to do this the way a historian should do it. And to understand really several things. One would be to understand what are the really important events, the important UFO events, the important encounters that we need to know about. I've certainly tried to do that. Second thing I try to understand would be the politics. Does this matter to political organizations? Does this matter to the United States government or to other governments? Does this matter to any of the militaries of the world? Does it matter to the CIA or any other intelligence agency? I worked on this one a lot. And for the record, they do. They care a lot. Certain restricted groups within them care a lot. And then the other thing that I find fascinating, that I think is quite important, is to understand the history of how we have understood this. It's really history of our own consciousness in confronting this incredible mystery. How we have evolved. We're not in the place where we were in 1950 in understanding this. We're not in the place where we were in 1970 and 1990. We're in a very different place now. And that journey is one of the most fascinating journeys of the human mind that we've gone through in the last century. It really is. So those are the things that I really concern myself with as a historian. I try to weave it together in a narrative that makes some sense. Like all history, history is always provision. History is never final. So I expect and hope that other people will continue on any work that I've started and improve on and correct it. That's what it's all about. We're only trying to do the best we can and to understand this. But that's really how I do this. This is my approach to UFOs. And the other thing that I can tell you is that I do this full time. I've decided to basically throw my life onto the altar of ufology. I'm a sacrificial victim, but I don't mind. I actually do this all the time, and there are a lot worse things that I could be doing. So I want to talk about where I've been going in the last year thinking about this. I call it understanding UFOs with a 21st century mind. You know, think about it. Like when you go out into the world and you know, do you tell all of your friends? I love talking about UFOs. I bet many of you don't. People will look at you like, that's really silly. And there's this attitude that people around the world have, that UFOs are this silly, goofy little topic, suitable for immature minds, not really for grown-ups and mature thinkers. Well, it's absolutely false. And if you've studied this long enough, you realize that. I can just tell you, in my own communications with members of the U.S. intelligence community, I've had long conversations with individuals who are friends with multiple U.S. presidents, multiple directors of the CIA, multiple secretaries of defense. I haven't talked with those, but I've talked with people very close to them, many people close to them. And I can tell you, they're very, very, very interested in this. And they're brilliant people, of course. So there's you scratch the surface of our world, and you find a large community of, well, not large, a community of very, very, I say, plugged-in, intelligent people who take this seriously. So there's this great discrepancy. We've got this image of something that's really silly, and on the other hand, you start exploring and you find that it's important. So, now one thing that, 20 years ago when I started into this, almost 20 years ago, I was very conservative. I wanted to know one thing. I didn't even want to know if UFOs were real when I started. I only wanted to know, was this topic actually ever truly considered as something serious by the U.S. military? I didn't care if they were right or wrong. I just wanted to know, was it important to them? Because if it was, then I wanted to know, why had I never read about it in any academic history book? Ever. How could that not be interesting? You know, in the history of the early Cold War, let's say 1950, and you find out that some 3-star or 4-star general is actually really concerned about these objects that are invading sensitive airspace and wondering, is that Soviet or not? What are these things? I mean, in hell, yes, I want to know. If this was part of my country's history, I reasoned in the 1990s, then I want to know. Well, guess what? So I threw myself into this. I wanted to answer that question, and I very quickly learned that, oh yes, they certainly were interested. And that brings another question. Why were they interested? And also, did they ever stop being interested? And all of these other questions started happening. And that's the way it is with this topic. You can't just study one little thing. At least I can't. It would be like going to this beautiful ocean, this beautiful beach, and you see this gorgeous blue water, and you stick your little toe in there, and say, okay, well, that's good, I've had enough. That's really what the whole UFO phenomenon is. It's this incredible ocean. So eventually I decided to go swimming. And what I discovered is that this is a multifaceted phenomenon, that the deeper you go, the more it rewards you, or the more it can exasperate you, the more it can frustrate you. But my goodness, there's just so much you can look at when you talk about or study UFOs. You can study the history. You could spend your entire lifetime. You could spend several lifetimes studying the history of incredible stories from ancient times till today. Libraries and libraries of incredible stories and suggestive artwork and suggestive archaeological remains. It's a tremendous amount, as I think you all realize. You can also spend a lifetime or more studying the cover-up, studying the politics. A very good friend of mine, a Canadian named Grant Cameron, does exactly that. He's become an expert, probably the best expert, in studying U.S. presidential policy relating to the matter of UFOs. He's got a great website. And you could spend all of your time studying them. Similarly, you could study for years and decades and lifetimes the phenomenon of contact in all of its forms. In the video, just before I came on here, we saw Carol Rosen talking about her contact experience and her statement from this being that she related that all of these beings are positive. None of them are malevolent. Personally, I'm not so sure. I think that truth is a little bit complicated. I wouldn't say that she's wrong. No, I don't think, I think most people have very good ability to perceive things. But our problem is that we only see one side of things. So when you have a disagreement with somebody, it's really not a good idea to say you're really wrong, but it's a good idea to say, well, there's another side here. From where you're standing, that's exactly correct. So it's always good for us to understand where other people are coming from. But there's multiple sides to everything. When we talk about contact, we talk about different types of experience, many of which have and do traumatize people. I've spoken to many such people, and they continue to go on. They're continually abducted. But that's a facet of this that is incredibly profound, meaningful. And related to that, we can ask questions like, who are these beings? What are these beings? Do they look like us? Well, some of them seem to look very much like us, except they don't seem like us because, A, they're intensely telepathic. I'll be talking a little bit more about that later. Some of them don't seem to look like us either. So what's going on with all of that? Where might they be from? These are questions we don't really have as much information, but they're obvious questions that any reasonable, intelligent mind would want to ask. And then there's, more of a practical type of a question, which would be, how does one investigate this topic? How might it have been investigated in 1950 or 1960? And how might we investigate it today? We're in a different world. We're in a world of YouTube and Facebook. We're in a world where anyone can talk to anyone instantly, really. We're in a world not where we lack information, but where we really almost have too much. We're swimming in an ocean of information. How do we sort it out? How do we research this properly? These are really interesting questions to me. I've been thinking about it. You can spend a lot of time on that. Then you can ask all these scientific issues. I call it weird science. How is it possible for an object to hover indefinitely, silently, and then instantly accelerate? Gone. There it goes. How is it possible for these objects to zigzag? Well, they're probably not using jet fuel, so they're using something better than that. So how do they do it? That leads us into a lot of questions about propulsion, maybe things called electrogravitics. But there's more to science and UFOs than that. There's issues concerning energy. There's issues concerning space-time itself. Because, look, these things, there's strangeness. There's time distortions that appear to be involved when people have encounters with these things. There's the possibility, I think, that they can manipulate space-time itself. And then there's the whole issue of consciousness. I'm convinced that consciousness is very important in understanding this. There's a connection that we have with them, whoever they happen to be. All of these, I think, are critically important in understanding this topic today. Now, one of a book that I recently co-authored isn't a history. It's a book, it's a speculation about the future. I called it AD After Disclosure. And it's a speculation, but we try to be very pragmatic about it. Simple question. If you believe UFOs are real, if you believe there's a cover-up, then you might want to ask yourself, what happens if that secret were ever to end? How would it change our world? And that's really the book that we tried to write. It's the book that we did write. In my opinion, when we finished writing that book, I realized how radical, how revolutionary this entire topic is. And it made it very clear to me why there's secrecy. It's just another very important issue. And then I have at the bottom here, human consciousness and ET. Well, I guess I sort of discussed that a little bit already here, but this is very important. And moving into the future, I think it's going to become more important. I don't know exactly all of the ways that it'll play out that way, but I'm convinced that it's very important. On a personal basis, I don't really think that most of us will ever be ready for true open contact with these beings. Somehow I think that they're operating on a very different level than we do. And I don't know about you, but I have relatives and family, and I love them very much, but I do not think that they're going to be ready for that moment. On the other hand, who's ever ready for their first child? Nobody. So you learn as you go. My feeling is that humanity is on a path. It's like being on a train. That train is going to a destination, whether we like it or not, whether we're ready for it or not. The fact is, we're not ready. That's not going to stop us anyway. We're going to be there. So probably during this transition to a new era, there'll be a lot of panic and yelling and screaming and people running around pulling their hair out of their heads, but then eventually we'll have to settle down and deal with it. And I think that's when, as a species, we may begin to grow up. So all of that by way of just an introduction. So, you know, I try to balance myself between someone who's very pragmatic, factually oriented, but I do like to speculate. I have to. It's just the way that my mind works. So I'm always trying to distinguish for myself between what I feel that we know confidently and what we don't know. And we have to know the difference, it seems to me. So I've never been comfortable with accepting someone else's testimony based on trust alone. I don't like putting people in that position when I'm doing research or when I'm speaking. My feeling is everything that I show to you, you should be able to check. You should be able to investigate the truth of whatever it is I say. It's not always that simple because sometimes people have come to me privately and I have to promise not to reveal their names. So, I'm doing the same thing in a way. But I won't do it. I won't do it forever. Those people eventually will all be outed. But I don't like in principle the idea of trying to tell stories that you have to say, well, I think he's a good guy, so I guess I'll believe him. No. There are certain things I think we can know. There are certain things that we can say, this is how things look like. And as long as we don't push it too far, I think it's fair for us to speculate and also to go a little bit farther out of field. Here's one thing we know. There's a lot of UFO evidence. A lot. Photographs don't mean what they used to in the old days, it's true, but nonetheless, there's some very good photographic evidence of UFOs. The photographs that are up there, the images that are up there, one of those is a video, have been analyzed extensively, I would almost say exhaustively, and mind you, they all pass the test as legitimate, and there are many others. So yes, I think there's some very good photographic and video evidence of UFOs. Of course, in an age of YouTube, in an age of Adobe After Effects and Photoshop, look, everything's got to be questioned. Photographic and video just doesn't mean what it used to. So they all have to be supported by corroborating evidence. Nonetheless, they're important. And then the other element I'm going to get into more in detail in just a moment is documentation. It's really what I've spent most of my time doing. There's some very good documentation. There are documents out there that are not proven to be legitimate, although I think even a lot of those are. A lot of these are proven to be legitimate, like these and many others. So that's something that we can, you know, if you're ever in a debate with a skeptical friend, and they say, there's no evidence for UFOs, well, you can say, no, actually, there's some very good evidence for UFOs. There's also a long history, or at least let's say a long apparent history. I have not written in my two volumes of history about the ancient aspect of this. Although in my most recent book, AD, After Disclosure, I have, and in the book that I'm about to publish, I have more on this. What we have to say is that there's a lot of very compelling, suggestive evidence for something going back a long way in our history. It's not the same as proof. You've got some of these paintings, like in the bottom center, for example, that is an image from 5,000 years ago from Australia of beings that are known as the Wajina. They're called their sky gods. Now look how they look like that. There's no one in Australia who looks like that. On the bottom left is in Western United States, in Sago Canyon, Utah. Those are very, very tall images. They're about 5-6 meters tall. We don't know what they are. They're very early. If you've ever watched Ancient Aliens, then you know that that aircraft-looking item there actually can fly. If you put a propeller on it, that thing will fly. And there's much more that's very interesting. That's pre-Columbian, incidentally. So, just so happens to be aerodynamically perfect. Gee, how did they do that? So there's interesting suggestive things. And then there's some stories as well. I mean, one of the earliest good UFO story that I'm aware of is from ancient Egypt, from 3,500 years ago, in the 18th dynasty, in the reign of Thutmose III, that was the dynasty of Akhenaten. And describes for several days these glowing balls of fire coming from the sky and terrifying the Egyptians, who lay down on their bellies and then went to Pharaoh. Nobody knew what to do. For days, these objects burned brighter than the sun. This is in the Egyptian annals. Brighter than the sun for days, and then flew off. What is that? Well, we don't know. There were no investigators at the time. There was no one doing anything other than recording. But there's a few of these stories, and I think we would have much more if our ancient libraries at Alexandria and Constantinople and elsewhere had not been destroyed. It's a tragic loss. But what we have still is quite interesting. Back in the modern era, in terms of documentation, as I said earlier, there's really a lot. In my country, we were lucky. We had the Freedom of Information Act, which for, I guess you could say we still have the Freedom of Information Act, but it's not what it used to be. During the late 1970s, it actually worked pretty well. It was after Watergate, it was after Vietnam, the United States was probably in its most liberal political mood that it's ever been in, politically. And it, as a result, it was the most liberal interpretation of Freedom of Information Act that we've ever had. That actually ended with Ronald Reagan in the early 80s. So for about 5 years, mainly the Jimmy Carter years, UFO researchers were able to obtain a lot of really good UFO documents from the United States government. By themselves, none of these documents would be proof that UFOs are ET or alien. But I would say that if you take the top 50, the top 20, the top 15 or so, that is proof that there's a real phenomenon that demands an explanation. And furthermore, that was of great seriousness to upper level United States policymakers. And to me, that by itself ought to be a really big thing. That ought to be something that journalists should like shove this in front of the president and say, hey man, what's up with all this? Can't you explain this? Why is it so serious when, you know, you're telling us year after year that there's really nothing to that? Of course, journalists don't do that. In my opinion, this is a good top tier of some of the proven documents. You might like some others better. Some of them really are quite fascinating. I'll just mention maybe two or so of these. The top one among researchers is very well known, the 1947 Twining Memo. General Nathan Twining was a three-star Air Force general in 1947. He later became four-star general and ran the United States Joint Chiefs. At this time, he wrote a memo in answer to another general's question. General really wanted to know, hey, these flying saucers that I'm hearing about, do I have to do anything about this? Is this something that we're making? What's going on? And Twining wrote back a three-page type memo that said a few things. A, he said the phenomenon is real, not visionary or fictitious. That's rather important, considering the fact that at that exact time, the U.S. government was telling the people, it's visionary and fictitious. He says it's not visionary and fictitious. And he described a lot of the characteristics of these objects that military personnel had been reporting. My favorite was domed on top, flat on the bottom. Wow, what's flat on the bottom, domed on top, especially in 1947? Silent, he said, they take evasive action when sighted, extreme rates of climb and maneuverability. Hey, we're talking about some interesting objects here. But of course, all of this was kept away from the public at the time. That was a classified memo. Another interesting one, one of my favorites, they're all really excellent, is the 1952 CIA memo. It was written by the Director of Scientific Intelligence, H. Marshall Chadwell, to the Director of the CIA, Walter Beadle Smith. Back in World War II, Smith had been Dwight Eisenhower's chief of staff, particularly during the D-Day invasion. So by this point, he's running the CIA. And this had been after many, many months of intense, crazy UFO sightings, many of which were military related. And so by the end of the year, Chadwell writes this letter to Smith, and one of the key paragraphs says, at this time, reports of unidentified objects traveling at high altitudes at great speeds over sensitive U.S. defense installations are of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. And I read that and it just takes my breath away. I think, you know, what else is he going to say short of saying, boss, I think we're being invaded? And so we have these documents and they are quite fascinating. And it's, all of them are that way. I wrote an article a few years ago, which I called 12 Documents Proving U.S. Government Interest in UFOs, where I talk about all or most of these documents here. You can read high-resolution JPEGs of them. They're all reproduced, and I provide my own analysis of them. It's a basic article-length piece, and it's at my site at Keyhole Publishing. I would encourage you to read it. Let's leave that alone, though. We could talk about the documents for days. There's no need. Another thing that I believe has been very significant is, yes, I believe that there's been a retrieval of ET, or let's say highly exotic technology not made by human hands. Maybe they're not extraterrestrial. Maybe they're human-based aliens. Maybe they just live here. But in any case, there are a lot of surprisingly good avenues that indicate this. Not the same level of proof as the documents I was just showing you, admittedly. And one more thing I just want to mention regarding these documents. Even during the great era of freedom of information in the late 70s, it was never a sure thing that we would be able to get these documents. It was still difficult. And all of the highest classification documents were still and have remained unavailable to us. So there are many, many levels of classification. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But what we have got are not the most classified documents. We know that there are deeply classified documents. We just don't have them. So anyway, in the late 1970s, an American researcher by the name of Leonard Stringfield wrote a book that speculated a little bit on crash retrievals. That is, retrievals of crash UFOs. You know, at that time, that whole topic was just not discussed. It was this fringe, ridiculous, oh my God, never talk about it. Crash UFOs, you're crazy to do that. But what Stringfield did is he looked into some of them, including Roswell case, which had been forgotten for 30 years. And he just mentioned that one, and he mentioned a few other suggestive cases that had come up his way. And he wrote about it in the book, and it came out in the late 70s, and that was just when Jimmy Carter was becoming president. And that was important, because Jimmy Carter, you may know, had once seen a UFO himself and talked about it when he was running for president. I don't really think he wanted to talk about it, but he came out and he said, yes, in fact, I did see it. I don't know what it was. So there were people who had this idea that when Carter became president, or if he got elected, he might open up whatever records we had on UFOs. In fact, he did at one point say that he would do that. So there was this very hopeful attitude in 1977 when he became president. And that was just when Stringfield's book came out. And what happened was a lot of military insiders started coming up to Leonard Stringfield. A lot of them said, well, it looks like the president's going to start talking about this anyway, so let me tell you what happened to me back in the 1950s. Or sometimes the widow of a soldier, a military person would come up to him. One example would be the wife of someone, and she said, my husband told me once of a story when he was doing a security detail at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where he guarded 9 dead alien bodies in a room. And he told me about it. You know, these stories just come out of the blue, but here they are. One of Stringfield's people was a doctor. He knew all about this doctor, who told him in detail about having autopsied alien bodies. In the late 1970s, this was just really crazy stuff to deal with. But Stringfield was a very meticulous man. He was a good researcher, and he collected these stories and started eventually publishing. He got a lot of criticism, too, because he wasn't able to give up the identities of most of these people. Many of their identities are now known. But for a long time, he was under a lot of heavy criticism. But what it looks like is that, yes, there is a program to acquire exotic technology. Another man who's talked about this is a gentleman that I wouldn't say that I'm close friends with, but I'm friends with, and that's Apollo 14 astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell. I've spoken with him on a number of occasions about this topic. He's gone public. He doesn't talk about this much anymore, but he said many, many times, he told me personally, directly, that he had 2 ultra-elite contacts. And when you're an astronaut who's gone to the moon, who's not going to want to talk to you? Who's not going to want to be your friend? So basically, Edgar Mitchell can talk to pretty much anyone he wants to. And he is former U.S. Navy, so he's got a lot of connections. So he said he had 2 ultra-elite connections. He told him explicitly about programs to study alien technology and bodies. Now that's a famous man. It's not crazy. And I keep wondering, where's the media here, by the way? Where are the journalists saying, wow, can you elaborate? I mean, I've done it, but no one listens to me. In the mainstream, there are people who could actually break this story. People at NBC. In fact, a few years ago, I did a television show in the States. It was produced by NBC News. And I said exactly that to one of my producers. Because it was a UFO thing. And I said, look, if you really want to do a great story, go talk to Edgar Mitchell. But they have their limits. NBC is owned by General Electric, one of the top U.S. defense contractors. And in fact, the producers, some of them, were quite explicit with me about how limited they are and what they can do. It's very, very sad, and it's all about control, of course. Another interesting man is former U.S. Senator Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater ran for president once. Back in the 60s, he got beat pretty badly, but he ran. He was a Republican, pro-military. He was about like the perfect political candidate for the military. You know, they loved him. He was a general in the U.S. Air Force Reserve. He was close friends with Air Force legend General Curtis LeMay. And Barry Goldwater was also denied any kind of access to this information. He talked about a story once when he was chatting with Curtis LeMay. about this and asked if he could get any information. And he said, LeMay cussed him out. That is, LeMay yelled at him and used a lot of rough language and said, don't ever ask me about that again. We're friends. Don't ever do that again. Goldwater was really taken back. And he wrote about it a few times. His opinion was, it's impossible to get anything on this topic anymore. It is sealed shut. And when he wrote this letter here, this is 1981, this is right after a lot of documents had just been released through Freedom of Information. So he says, although I admit there is a lot that has been released, it's just impossible to get anything on it. We have a statement of another legendary man in the history of 20th century aerospace, Ben Rich. Ben Rich ran Lockheed's famous Skunk Works division. Ben Rich was the man who was really in charge of the development of the stealth fighter, the F-117A Nighthawk. Pretty cool airframe, aircraft. Ben Rich was very interested in UFOs. Toward the end of his life, started writing about them privately to friends. Started talking about it shortly before he died. He gave a speech in 1993 at the University of California, UCLA, at School of Engineering. And basically the lecture was the history of Skunk Works and all this cool stuff. And then he ended with a statement. His last statement of it was, we now have the technology to take ET home. It's pretty interesting. You know, everyone's different. Some people are very curious. Some people don't have a curious bone in their body. So about 3/4 or more of the people stood up and they just filed out of the room. Some people stayed behind and they surrounded Ben Rich. They're like, what? What are you talking about? We have the technology to take ET home. And so they asked him a lot of follow-up questions. And according to one man who was there, who I know, Ken Harzik, who's an IBM executive and one of the top people now at the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, in the States. Jan was there, and according to Jan, Ben Rich's verbatim statements were, we now know how to travel to the stars. He said, there's an error in the equations, and we have figured it out, and we now know how to travel to the stars, and it won't take a lifetime to do it. That is, it won't take a lifetime for you or me to go to the stars. He said, it's time to end all the secrecy on this as it no longer poses a national security threat. Remember, the Cold War had just ended. And made the technology available for use in the private sector. And then the last sentence, which Jan said was a paraphrase, but he said it's very out of here, is that there are many in the intelligence community who would like to see this stay in the black and not see the light of day. In the black, of course, meaning the deeply classified world. Ben Rich died about 2 years later. In the last week of his life, he had a conversation with another journalist named James Goodall, who is this man right here, and also made some very, very, according to Goodall, very detailed statements about the reality of ETs and UFOs. Goodall himself, in 1980, was really one of the best, most important journalists, I think, in doing UFO research. He wasn't really a UFO researcher, but he kind of bumped into it. He was, before there was Bob Lazar, who started talking about this in the late 80s, James Goodall was researching the Groom Lake facility, what we call Area 51 and all the related areas there, where the U.S. does all its, or some of its, important reverse engineering or technology research and development. And he started bumping into stories about UFOs, and he spoke to one non-commissioned officer with 11 years experience at Groom Lake and said, do you believe in UFOs? The guy said, absolutely, positively they exist. There was no belief involved here. And he went on to say, look, we have things in the Nevada desert that would make George Lucas envious. And then he went on, he said, better than Star Wars, better than Star Trek, better than anything you can see in the movies. That's a direct quote. Now, again, this is some guy talking. You can choose to believe it or not. But Goodall cultivated a number of his people. This is back in the mid-1980s, quite a while ago. So you have to wonder, there's a lot of smoke here. Is there fire? Well, I certainly think that there is. I certainly think that there is. And yet we have all of this stuff appearing to go on. And you go to the White House. Well, actually, you know you can't go to the White House. They don't let anyone near anymore. They'll shoot you if you try to go past a certain place. But you could try to talk to the White House people and ask them about UFOs. In fact, I was a co-author of one of the petitions recently to the White House. The White House now has a petition system where you can create a petition. And if you get enough signatories, they'll respond. I co-authored one about a year ago. We didn't get enough signatures. So. But it was all about acknowledging, or at least looking into, the UFO reality. My heart really wasn't in it, but I did it anyway. So I'm more of a researcher than an activist. Anyway, you go to the White House, and all they do is they issue denials. The Obama White House just last year said, there is no evidence that UFOs are legitimate, words to that effect. In fact, there's no evidence that there's any life anywhere else in the universe. That was the Obama White House. So they, right from Harry Truman, right through today. But ask yourself a question. Let's pretend that you were Harry Truman back in the 1940s, and pretend that your top generals and scientists approached you. And they said, sir, we have recovered technology that does not appear to have been made by our civilization. So, you've got this, wow, amazing piece of information. You have to process that. What do you do with it, really? I'm not defending the secrecy. But it's not hard to see why they would keep it secret. First of all, you have an incipient Cold War going on. You got those bad old Soviets thinking, well, if we tell the world we got this technology, it might be kind of hard not to share it. After all, in 1947, the United States had a monopoly on atomic weapons. They didn't want to share those. Big issue in 1947 was that the United Nations wanted the U.S. to make nuclear technology under international control. Go back and read it. It was a big issue at the time. U.S. answer was, sorry, no thank you. We'll just hang on to this ourselves. So they didn't want to share atomic technology. They're certainly not going to share something as exotic as ET technology. No, of course not. They're going to study it. They're going to try. And plus, they probably didn't have no idea who these other beings were, right? The world just finished the most cataclysmic, titanic struggle ever, the Second World War. Millions of people were homeless, on the verge of starvation, around in Europe and Asia. Everyone's trying to get back to some semblance of a normal life, which wasn't there. And now this thing drops into the lap of policymakers. They had to be just thinking, oh, there is no way we're going to tell the world about this. Especially when we don't know where they are. So the most logical thing to do, it makes perfect sense to me, is the president or whoever controls the president is going to say, let's get a team together and we're going to figure this out. And, one person will be in charge of having the technology studied. Another person will be there to find out, let's see how we can manage the academic community, the media, the political community, contain this. Someone else will find out how bad public panic might be. Someone else will figure out, who are these other beings? How do we communicate with them? So for all of the logical questions, I would feel confident that this is what happened. So that's why I think the secrecy will start. There's other reasons why I think, I say, why the disconnect? In other words, why the disconnect between this obvious reality and this stonewall in silence? Well, one I mentioned, Cold War realities. Another, though, is petroleum. I mean, even a 10-year-old kid could realize from looking at any of these objects that they're not using gasoline. They're using something a little bit better. Whatever it is, it's not going to be gasoline. And that implicitly is a challenge to the world's largest industry. And in 1947, 1957, and 1967, petroleum was where it was at. That was the growth industry. It was a money maker. And there was no need to rock the boat. The world's infrastructure was heavily built around oil, even then, of course. Oil had won the war. Oil had lost the war. It was all about oil. And it had to be understood that implicitly there was something better than oil. And what if it couldn't easily be monetized, that is, controlled, as easily as petroleum? I mean, after all, I think we can realize today that our political leaders aren't really so much elected as they are selected by powerful financial interests behind the scenes. Well, it was the case in the 1940s. And so if you have powerful interests looking at this, they would probably think, wait a minute, let's just hold off on this. Let's think about it, let's not be hasty. And then you have the issue of social control. Again, panic. I had a friendly debate a few months ago with another American writer named Daniel Pinchbeck. I'm not too familiar with him. Daniel's a very interesting guy. I like him. We're both New Yorkers. And his attitude, though, is that people can handle disclosure. People generally can handle the reality of this topic, and I disagree. I think that some people may be able to handle it. But could we really handle the reality of knowing that there are other beings who, if you were to encounter them, could get right totally into your head, totally know everything you're thinking? Because there are stories, good ones in my opinion, that tell exactly that. So, you know, we have, I believe, we have capabilities as well like that, but I don't think we're at their level. We're not at their level. I think many people would not handle this news well. In particular, if Carol Bronson is a little bit wrong, and if there are maybe some groups that may not be all that nice. I don't believe that advanced technology is a prerequisite, a necessity. However, I don't think that having very advanced technology necessarily means that you are ethically or morally advanced. I don't believe that there's a connection. And I hear this a lot, by the way, you know, the idea that, well, if they learn to travel through space and time, they've obviously learned how to work and live peacefully. I'm sorry, I don't see the logic. That would be like if we as a group went back 1,000 years to some medieval village with our iPhones and our iPads and our nice clothes and our shiny teeth, and we would go back there and we would be like gods to them, really. They would look at us and think, wow, you guys have got it all figured out. You must have all of your problems solved. And all we would have to do is just look at each other and say, don't say anything. Don't give it away. We're just as rapacious and violent and greedy as ever. Why should it be impossible that there are interstellar economic hitmen? If you're familiar with the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins, why should it be impossible that there would be aggressive species that are ahead of us technologically? I don't think it's impossible. So I'm not saying that that's the case. I'm just saying in theory, there could be a lot of reasons for panic. And in general, I think there's just a fear of the unknown. I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations with people just one-on-one about this topic, and I get into it for 2, 3, 4 minutes, and at the beginning they're like, wow, I love UFOs. It's so cool that you research UFOs. But you can tell like their interest is very superficial. And then they find out that I'm like really into this. And some people love it, and some people just stop. They don't want to hear anymore. They put up this wall. It's the same thing with 9/11, which I also studied, which also gave me a lot of grief in my own country. I got stopped for 2 years at U.S. Air Force because I'm pretty sure of what I used to say in 9/11. People don't want to get into that either. UFOs is a similar topic. I really think it's a case where we, when you get to a certain age in life and then you stop and you think, okay, I've got my world figured out. Now I'm going to spend the rest of my life filling in the blanks of what I think I already know, because that's a lot easier. That's for me too. I don't really like to have to reinvent my worldview every couple of years. I'm in the habit of it now, I will say. This topic did it to me. Anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that I think there are a lot of reasons why there would be. this, on the one hand, this intensely profound reality, on the other hand, this silence. And, you know, let's keep in mind that those people at the top of our human food chain really want to stay at the top. They don't want things to rock the boat. Another reason why there's going to be silence on this topic is because I believe that this phenomenon, UFO phenomenon, is a key creator of the United States black budget economy. Not the only one. We've all heard about the atomic bomb and how that was secret and so forth. But think about it. After World War II, the UFO phenomenon becomes this real thing. Let's say reacquire some of their technology. Now you want to study it. Well, that takes money. But you can't let Congress know about it, because if you let Congress know about it, there goes the secret. So you have to create a classified secret allocation for it. You create a black budget. Well, technically speaking, that's illegal in the U.S. system. So you create this illegal structure, and you can justify it all you want, but the fact is it becomes a secret that perpetuates itself. And the deeper you go, the more entangled the secret becomes. The deeper the bureaucracy goes, the more profitable it becomes, too, because, after all, you're holding the future in your hands with technology. Let's assume that they've made some breakthroughs in understanding. So they've known something. Another reason there's secrecy or silence, I'm not going to read this whole poem. This is a fun 19th century English poem. But it's about, you probably heard this story, some of you, about six blind men feeling an elephant. So they're blind, so they can't see it. So each person's feeling a different part of the elephant and saying, oh yeah, it's a spear, you know, feeling the tusk. It's a fan. It's a wall. It's a rope, a tree, a snake. And I'll just read you the last two stanzas because it really is funny. And so these men of Hindustan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion, exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right and all were in the wrong. So oft in theologic wars, the disputants, I mean, that is, I believe, rail on in utter ignorance of what each other mean, and prate about an elephant not one of them has seen. Back to the difficulty of this topic. The UFO phenomenon is that elephant. It's very difficult. It's very elusive. Is it about men or women from another planet coming here? Probably not that simple. That's how I started on this journey years ago, but I realize it's very complex indeed. And even if they are from another planet, which is certainly possible, I mean, why not? It's a lot of planets out there, is probably a lot of life in the universe. And we ourselves are less than probably 50 years away. 50 years, I bet, from having not only computers that will talk to you and tell you that they're conscious, that will have an IQ much higher than us. They won't need sleep, they won't need coffee in the morning, they'll just go. We'll have quantum computing, probably, or maybe. We'll have nanotechnology that will be off the charts. We'll have a world that's not going to be recognizable. Do you really think that in that time we're not going to be able to go to another star system? Maybe not you and me, but maybe an artificial intelligent machine or ship? I bet we can. What are the odds you think that some other species have already done that? So they could be extraterrestrial, but they could be something else that's more complex. That's the story of the elephant. In my country, really worldwide, I don't know about Norway really, but probably at least similar. No one's as secretive as the United States these days. My country, we've got absolutely runaway secrecy. There have not been many open, good analyses of the U.S. black budget. There have been a couple that are publicly known that are not too bad. One was just a couple of years ago in the Washington Post. One was a little over a decade ago. All of them describe a situation that is out of control, in which no one really even knows how much money goes into this system, because it's more than just tax dollars that are classified. Look, there's financial securities fraud, stock market fraud. There's narco trafficking money. It all goes in there. How could it not? Narcotics trafficking is one of the top five money-making businesses in the world. Do you really think that no one's going to want that money just because it's illegal? Everybody wants that money. Particularly intelligence groups, which of course have to rig elections, raise secret armies, do all of these things that they want. Of course, they want their own unvouchered money. It's the best thing in the world for them. So no one really knows how expansive this world is. So for us to get information, so all of these things that I'm describing are difficulties for anyone who wants to research this phenomenon. We got a very difficult phenomenon to start with, and it's enveloped in national security secrecy. So really, for a truth seeker, that's what I am, and I think that's probably what most of you are. If you want to know, we have our work cut out for us. And on top of that, this is an image that I rather like. I call it the secrecy iceberg. I talked earlier about how most of the documents that we have received in Freedom of Information are not of the deepest levels of secrecy, and that's really the case. There are many, many levels. And what we've gotten is just the very top. There are classifications, within classifications, where it'll never be known. It'll probably never be known just how far this goes. But there's a deep, deep. For example, there are these special access programs. That's the primordial black budget program. But then there are what are known as waived special access programs, or waived unacknowledged special access program. So an unacknowledged special access program is a special access program that doesn't exist, except that it does exist. And then a waived unacknowledged special access program is one that not only does it not exist, but is waived from congressional review. So it doesn't have to be reviewed by any member of Congress. And so it goes. And how many of them? No one knows. And beyond that, one of the things that these few studies that I mentioned earlier pointed out is how privatized the system has become. And that's also very important. Because once a secret becomes privatized, it's no longer just classified, it's proprietary, which is even better. And think about it in terms of understanding UFO tech. So, you got this object that's got to be studied. How do you study it? Well, eventually you got to send it to private industry, like Lockheed or Boeing or General Dynamics or Raytheon, because they've got the research and development guys, they've got the engineers, they really have the ability to replicate it. So at some point, all that technology is going to be moved into private hands. So how does that work? I don't really know how it works. I assume that the lawyers covertly work out an agreement, and maybe if I'm a general and I give it over to Lockheed, then I can retire, and then I can become senior vice president at Lockheed, and I can make a lot of money off of this, too. I think that's really how it works. So it all becomes privatized. It's all privatized. And a number of sources, including a few that I've had the privilege to speak to privately, quietly, have confirmed the same thing, that the private contractors dominate, that they have more leverage and more power than the U.S. Defense Department officials do in these black budget programs, typically. And often the lawyers of the private contractors have the most power. So this is how I envision the development of extraterrestrial technology to go. You get retrieval of a crashed UFO, you transfer the technology to private groups, it goes very deeply secret. And what would they be trying to do? I have to think one of the things they'd be trying to do would be build their own flying saucers. If you're not doing that, then they're idiots. Of course they're going to try to do that. What do? You sit on your hands looking at this for 60 years? Obviously, they're going to try to replicate it. Would there be a secret space program as well? My argument is probably yes. Of course they're going to try to. By the way, I wasn't planning to get into this here with you, but there is a very surprisingly good level of video evidence of truly strange things going on in Earth orbit. Things that really don't make sense. Now, yes, many things that we think of as anomalies out there are actually dust and ice crystals, and they can be confusing. But there are things that have been recorded in orbit that defy, as far as I can see, defy any conventional explanation. And I do believe our evidence that there is revolutionary technology, clandestine, out in space. Whether it's something that we've created or something that they have created, that I do not know. Now, the last couple of years, I've been developing a theory. I call it a breakaway civilization. It's kind of a neat sounding thing. I don't know if it's actually true, but I think it's true. I will say this. I had a conversation. Well, we all know, first of all, that the classified world frequently is going to be technologically ahead of the rest of us. I think we can all recognize that. Right now in my country, the National Security Agency has just opened a data collection center. Isn't that a nice name? Out in Utah. What does it do? Well, it's the ultimate Big Brother center. It's got every single email that I have ever written and that every other American has written. Maybe every email that you've ever written. You may not have all of your emails from 2004, but they do. Maybe you could go to Utah and knock on their door and say, hey, by the way, this is from September to January of 2005. They say, sorry, you don't have the need to know. But they're probably using, there's a lot of talk that they're using quantum computers for that. I don't know that they are, because I haven't admitted it, but it's quite possible they have. They're way ahead. I had a conversation with a former NSA scientist who worked there in the mid-1960s. And you know, the NSA wasn't publicly revealed until 1964. And this scientist was working for them at that time, in 1964. And he said to me that the NSA computers at that time, the best ones that he knew of, were running at a clock speed of 650 megahertz. Now today, that's not impressive at all. But keep in mind that the personal computing world did not reach that clock speed until around the year 2000. So this is about 35 years. And in fact, there were no personal computers in 1965. So the NSA was, on that measurement, 35 years ahead of the rest of us. Not too big. You have to wonder where they are today. So let's take that thought and then throw some ET technology in there. And we ask ourselves, what happens when, let's say we're part of all this group, like we're the classified group. So we have total deep secrecy. We have teams of genius level scientists. We have recovered ET technology, and we have a lot of money and a lot of time, a lot of time. What might we come up with? Well, that's a good question. I suspect that we would come up with some real money-making opportunities. That's a no-brainer. We would come up with some, lasers maybe, or fiber optics, or high-tensile fibers, or better integrated circuits. You know, take your pick. Now, you could look up the official history of those technologies, and they don't talk about aliens, of course, but hiding that would not really be the hardest thing to do. So if we were to make breakthroughs like that, we would have real good money-making opportunities, nice investment opportunities. There goes any incentive for giving the secret up, by the way. But what if we came up with better breakthroughs than that? Breakthroughs like in anti-gravity, or breakthroughs in energy, something that might replace petroleum. Guarantee you, I know what would happen. Our bosses would say, not so fast. Keep studying it, but it's not going to make it to the public. Keep working. So we might create our own flying saucer. We might have the ability to go off the planet's atmosphere, have to go out into space without anyone knowing. We could have a whole lot of things. And you know how science works. Science builds on itself. One breakthrough can lead to another, which might lead to others and lead to others. But if you prevent the rest of the world from that one breakthrough, they're not going to get to where we go. So if we develop our own flying saucers, it's my opinion that we have, maybe we would have encounters with these other beings that the rest of the world wouldn't have. Maybe we would learn things in terms of science and cosmology that they wouldn't have. Ask yourself this question. What is it that constitutes a distinct civilization? Might be a hard question to answer, but I think about it sometimes. Certainly, technology would be one thing. Certainly, your cosmology, your understanding of yourself in the universe would be another. Maybe your social relations with each other and the rest of the world. Well, in all of these things, I would say that this group is very distinct. Maybe so distinct that they would qualify as a separate civilization, one that has, as I say, broken away from our own, hence a breakaway civilization. I'm not saying that they all live on Mars. I'm not saying that they all live under a massive underground facilities, although I think there are massive underground facilities, and they probably spend a lot of time there. But I also think that Earth is where the action is. I also think that they still have families, and they have family reunions and barbecues and whatever else they do. So it's not like they just go far away. But I think of it as an extreme version of what we already know about the classified world. The secrets that they probably have. Probably highly stressful secrets, I would think. But also secrets that give them a great deal of latitude from the established system. And one other thing that I would suggest is that they don't answer to the United States president. In fact, let me just back up and mention this. I feel that this is almost certainly the case. If you just take UFOs out of the picture for a moment and just look at, let's just look at U.S. politics. It is the most obvious thing that U.S. presidents work. I mean, do parties really matter? I can say this to you. You know they don't matter. I go back into the United States and people still get worked up. Democrat, Republican. I say, what is wrong with you people? What is wrong with you people? It's not like that. You've got the same financial power behind both parties. That control, totally control both parties. The only difference, of course, is that they speak to different social constituents. That's it. You all probably heard of Jesse Ventura. I love Jesse Ventura. I've never met him. Now, before he became a politician, Jesse Ventura was a championship wrestler. Well, he was also a Navy SEAL. But then he got on TV as, you know the championship wrestlers are. They, like, get on the TV, I'm going to kick your ass, you're going down. And then the other guy would get in the seat, I'm going to get you. Well, Jesse Ventura talked about this. It's on YouTube. He's sitting next to Willie Nelson. And it's like completely casual sort of situation. Someone just got their little camera and they're listening to Jesse talk. And he says, politics is exactly like championship wrestling. It's exactly like it. Because in championship wrestling, we pretended to like hate each other. But like we were each the godfathers of each other's children. And we would go to each other's barbecues and we were like really close friends. And it's exactly that way in politics. The whole thing is a big game, you said. Well, we all know that, but it was just very refreshing to hear a national figure in politics talk like that. So yes, I mean behind the scenes, you've got major financial power, and that's who I think the deeply clandestine groups answer to, not just in the UFO part of it, but really within the whole classified world. You know, just look at someone like David Rockefeller, who I think that Rockefeller's official age is 213 years old or something like that today. He's getting up there. That was a joke. He's actually 96, but he's still very old. And David Rockefeller has probably been behind the choice of, I would have to say, probably every single American president since the 60s, at least since the 70s. And Rockefeller maybe the people around him. Anyway, let me shift gears a little bit now. I talked about the difficulties in the enigma of this phenomenon itself. And it's been a long road for us to get to where we are in understanding UFOs today. You know, back in the 1950s, you had people talking about beautiful Nordic supermodels who were the aliens. You know, they all came from Norway, apparently. Blonde, gorgeous. I have a few really good and creepy stories about beautiful blonde aliens, and I will tell them to you in a moment. fact that they look better than the creepy reptoids in Grace, yeah, that's cool. So if someone's going to take over our world, I do want them to look like that, not that, admittedly, but nonetheless. So we go from that to, you know, to like this is a 1950 book. And it took years. I mean, in the early decades of understanding this, no one would even talk about abductions. That was not part of the discussion. No one would talk about crash retrievals of UFOs. That was not part of the discussion. It took generations. And I think it's really because our own world views, because people don't really change. Their children change. That's the only... People very seldom change their worldview after a certain age. I really believe this. But now as the father of two teenagers, I can see firsthand that, wow, you know, my kids, they see the world in ways that I actually would not have been able to imagine. But they grew up in a completely different environment. And that's how change really is made. And that's how change, I think, has happened within the study of UFOs as well. So the old generations of the 50s and 60s saw things in a certain way, and it really wasn't until they were gone from the scene that new people would look at this in a new light and so on. And that's really how it's gone. And it's now been almost 70 years of this. And we're still not there. And we still have difficulties. One very high-level, brilliant insider described this field to me as a hall of mirrors. And not just the field of research, but the inside, the intelligence world. It's a hall of mirrors. How do we know what we know? That's a really difficult question. For example, this isn't like the 1960s anymore, the 1950s. We have an enormous amount of data to work with. Less data in Europe than in North America. But the European data is starting to increase a lot too. Like in North America, you go online to the National UFO Reporting Center on the web. And every year they put up about 5,000 sightings that are reported. Most of them don't get investigated, so we don't really know. And let's remind ourselves that 90% of any of the strange things that people do see are probably conventional objects or explainable things, certainly. But there's still an enormous amount out there. And then there's the database of MUFON, which is another group. They've got another several thousand a year, and there's not a lot of overlap there. So there's just, I mean, a wealth of data to go through, and we lack the ability to investigate most of these. There's YouTube. My God. You want to look at UFO videos? Go to YouTube and type in UFO video 2012 and see how many you get. And the problem, of course, is how do you know which ones are legitimate? I'm not very good with After Effects, with video editing, but I'm getting pretty good with Photoshop. So, you know, making a fake UFO photo, of course, anyone can do that. UFO videos, a lot of people can do that too. And a lot of them do that. And on top of the fact that a lot of the videos are legitimate, but they're just of ordinary things that are misidentified. In other words, most of these videos are not very valuable. They're certainly not valuable without corroborating testimony. And they're certainly not valuable if the person uploads them anonymously, or if you really can't speak to them. So it's just more clutter in our lives. There's social media, i.e. Facebook, the world's latest, greatest addiction. And Facebook is great. I have a lot of great friendships on Facebook. But and a lot of information, too. For the record, I have a very cool Facebook page. I have a lot of great friends who put great stories on my page, and I'm very happy about that. But Facebook is also like, you know, the tabloid of the internet. It's like copy and paste journalism. You know, you can spread actual news, and also you can spread rumor just like that. And we've all seen it, and especially in this field, where paranoia runs rampant all the time. So, and where, you know, there are self-appointed gurus who will put things out there. Everything is plastered all over the place. It's just more distraction. At the same time, we've had a decline of professional journalism in this world, really generation. Corporate media is just, you know, gobbled each other up. There are basically, I think six media giants that control, at least in the U.S., probably worldwide, that control more than 50% of everything that you are likely to read, see, or hear in the course of your day. It's probably owned by one of six corporations. And then if you take the top 10 altogether, I think they control something like 75 to 80% of everything. Holy crap, that's a lot. And what they've learned is that journalism is expensive. What's much better for them are these stupid reality TV shows that say nothing whatsoever. And also journalism that masks as, rather opinion that masks as journalism. And at least in America, my God, that's all we get. We get these blowhard, usually right-wing, but sometimes less right-wing ideologues that get out there and blah, blah people, and they hammer home their opinions. But it's really not news. But it's a lot cheaper to just have some guy or gal who can just talk. Because investigating takes money, and it's going away. So we have a shortage of actual investigation. And the, I just came from a really great gathering conference in Copenhagen just the last couple of days. And I met with some outstanding European investigators, one from Sweden, one from Portugal, and one from Germany. All of them do really superb work, far more professional than what I typically see in the United States. But there's still in Europe almost no really good central repository of UFO sightings that I'm aware of. And in the U.S., there's really not a good one either. I mean, you've got these databases, but these cases don't get investigated. There's MUFON, I suppose, which does some investigation. Of course, the problem is we don't find out the results of any of the investigation, so why bother? MUFON's reports probably end up going to some national security archive, since all of their upper board members are former U.S. intelligence. So that's a problem. Then we have more problems. We have these field that is littered with outrageous and unsubstantiated claims. And I don't want to get on Carol Ross's case, because I like Carol, and I've known her, and I respect her. But it's just another example of claims that are out there that I cannot test. I can't prove it. And she's better than most. So Carol, if you ever watch this on YouTube, I think you're great. Don't take it the wrong way. But the problem that we have in this field is that everything has to be taken on trust. That's the wrong way to go in. You know, there's a certain subjectivity to this that just, it doesn't help. It doesn't help. I understand that sometimes that's just how it is, but we have to be aware to make claims that are outrageous. Project Bluebeam, if you've heard of this, I'm sure some of you have. Project Bluebeam is I call it a meme. It's been out for about almost 20 years now in one form or another. And the idea is a fake alien invasion that would scare the shit out of you so that you would hand over your rights to Big Brother. And look, I believe in false flags. I took a year out of my life to study 9/11. My father worked at the World Trade Center, by the way. My dad's a retired New York City cop who had the day off. He shared his job with a very nice man who was killed that day. I spent a lot of time investigating 9/11, and I would go to my, hopefully not grave, but I would, for the rest of my life, I would talk about how that was an inside job. I believe it with every fiber of my being. So I know that there are false flags. Thumbs up, yes, I agree. So, but pulling off a fake alien invasion, I've never seen the logic, I've never seen the logistics, I've never seen how this could ever possibly be done. And I've never seen evidence for it. I hear talk, 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 and I really see any evidence for it. And I don't buy it. There was a prediction a couple of years ago that there was going to be a Project Bluebeam event for, I think it was supposed to be October of 2010. Yes, and about a week before it supposedly happened, I wrote an article that said, not going to happen. Not going to happen. Of course it didn't happen. The logistics in pulling off something like that are beyond, I mean, if 9/11 was difficult, this would be 100 times harder to do, I think. But there are other things that they can do. There's the claim that HARP, that is high altitude, the World Research Project, causes earthquakes. That it caused, Fukushima and other things. I'm not saying advanced weapons can't do it and don't exist. I believe they do. The evidence for HARP doing it, haven't seen. Time travel claims. I'm going to a conference in California next week where one prominent gentleman was talking about time traveling and going to Mars and speaking. Suffice to say, I don't believe them. I don't believe the claims. I believe in a lot of crazy things. I think that the older I get, the more I encounter some very strange things. And I'm not saying that such technology is even completely impossible. But here's what I find. There are a lot of people who have had encounters with the U.S. intelligence community whose minds have been completely screwed with. I'll give you a perfect example. I interviewed a woman before I published my first book. This is back in the 90s. Who had been in the U.S. Air Force. She left the Air Force in 1982. I don't know what she did. She had a top secret clearance of some sort. She described her debriefing and discharge from the U.S. military out of Okinawa in 1982. She said, "My debriefing lasted for months. Months. And I went through three phases. Phase one was I sat across the table from a debriefing officer, and it was a meeting, basically, let's get your story straight. When you go to the outside world, you don't tell them that you did this, you don't tell them you did this, right? Get it?" Phase two was the phase she really didn't like. She was given sodium pentothal and subjected to what she called hostile interrogation. So she was given like a truth serum and she was tortured. With the idea being, what would she give up if she were captured by hostile agents and tortured? Well, I would think that would be a very not fun phase. Then the third phase, she said, was nicer. Although when I think about it, I don't know that it was nicer. She was brought into a room with men who were wearing civilian clothing, which made her feel better. And she sat down in a chair, and they put a helmet on her head, and the helmet had wires connected to a board or a device which had knobs and switches and dials. And they did whatever they did, they scrambled up her memories. At that moment, I realized that the whole time I've been talking with her, she's very intelligent, but like she took an extra long time to answer any single question. I would ask her something, she would pause, then she would answer. I asked her, "Well, did they scramble up your memories from when you're like before the military, like high school?" She said, "I honestly don't know." So I assume that it messed her up. Whitley Strieber, the writer, had a story that struck a chord with me. He had grown up with a friend who was apparently a genius kid, smartest kid in the neighborhood, and that kid went off to work for the NSA, National Security Agency. Had a long career there. And Whitley talked about meeting this person, this friend, after that friend had retired from the NSA. They had lunch in a diner. And he said it was heartbreaking because his friend just wasn't there. His mind was gone. Something had been done to him. So what I'm saying here with some of these claims, you get these people who are whistleblowers, and I'm not saying anyone in particular because I don't know. But I think that there are people who've had some very deep experiences. But the problem is they've also been given additional memories that are non-sequiturs. And that don't make sense. So that if they talk, this other crazy thing comes out too, or comes out wrong. Like with this woman that I mentioned earlier, part of the scrambling of her memories was like, she couldn't remember, did I do this or this? In the sequence of things, did I do this first, then this, or this first, then that? So that things just weren't right. There's a psychiatrist, an academician by the name of Elizabeth Loftus. You can Google her. She's very prominent in the field of memory. One thing that she said years ago is, it's very chilling to me. She said, "We can give anyone any memory we desire." So just think about that. When you hear some of these whistleblowers who come out of nowhere, And they talk and talk, and then they say something that's really crazy. Just keep in mind, it's a complex world. It's not all or nothing. There are shades and shades and shades of truth. Claims, more unsubstantiated claims, secret wars. I'm guessing some heard that a little over a year ago, we all got lucky, apparently, when the good guys blew up an underground base of bad guys in September, I believe, 2011. Well, good for us, yay. How do you prove? No way of proving. Of course, it's all based on trust. Trust me, I know what happened. And now, of course, it could be, what is this, September, so in 3 months, if you've been good, if you're 51% good, you might ascend. You can shed your mortal coil and become something better than human. This has been predicted. You can tell I don't believe it. No, I don't. I'm not saying that we don't strive for higher consciousness, because I firmly believe in that. Firmly believe in that. Maybe not the same way that some other people do. The problem that I have with all of these outrageous claims, these unsubstantiated claims, in part is that they litter our field. They're time wasters as well. And again, the fundamental is that they're untestable, they're unprovable. I think predictions are the bane of this field of ours. All kinds of predictions. Last year, oh my God, remember the comet Elenine? Anyone remember the comet Elenine? Predicted that this did not predict, it was a ship, supposedly. It was coming. It was going to be here about a year ago. Almost exactly a year ago, it was supposed to be arriving. And it was going to, it was like Nibiru, it was Planet X, it was whatever. It was these other beings, and they were going to be here. Then, of course, it wasn't any of that, it was a comet. And then what happened after that? Disappeared from the alternative news, no one talks about it. Gone. 6 months of wasted time. So we have problems in our research community. I think I'm going way over my allotted time, by the way, for which I apologize. But hopefully this is entertaining. So we have problems with our own research community. We need to police ourselves a little bit better. I don't know how it's going to be possible. It seems to me that people love to believe certain things. You know, I've occasionally thought that I could really make a lot more money if I were to grow my hair long and say that I received a message from a North American, Native American shaman guy who has given me certain messages of, you know, peace, love, ascension, whatever. I could wear purple shirts and beads and things like that. And I'll tell you, man, people would love that. At least in California. They would totally dig that. I'd make a lot of money from my lectures. People who want to believe certain things. And there's always going to be someone willing to fulfill that belief. On the other hand, we have problems with our own community. But we have to remember, okay, we're getting screwed by the guys at the top. We truly are. Think of it this way. I mean, the world's wealth is so top-heavy. If this were the world, let's say there were 100 people there, and, you know, everyone had like $100, euro. That's not Asian currency. I don't even know if they're moving currency. That's so ignorant. Forgive me. I just left Denmark. So we all have $1. It's my country. I'm talking. They'll say, we all have $1. $100 in the room. The one person, you get $40. Not too bad. Maybe 45 of the available dollars. And the next person, next thing, gets $10 or $11. Pretty nifty. So those top two people have 55% of all the money in the room. People in the back, you get nothing, sorry. You get zero. Some of you will get like maybe $1 or maybe 50 cents. Most of you get like 10, 15 cents. And that's really our world. So in this room, we have we have all these things that make our society go. We've got a political system. We've got a financial system. We've got an educational system. We have media. We have elections. Ask yourself a simple question. Who's going to be in the best position to manipulate those institutions for his benefit? Well, it's this guy with the $40. And maybe assisted by the guy next to him who's got some money. So you have the owner class, you have the manager class, you got the worker bees, and you got the extenders. That's our four-class system in the world today. That's how it is. And the worker bees, that's what I call them. They have to hate the expendables in the back because that class warfare keeps everyone up in arms and they can fight with each other. And then every 4 years you have the elections, and what do people talk about? Well, in my country, they certainly don't talk about who owns what. No, they'll talk about, you know, flag, the American flag in schools, the Pledge of Allegiance, abortion. There's a good one. That'll never get resolved, ever. All these issues that are important to people, but they're not fundamental issues of power. And that's a system, of course, in which they own the media. And so what's our media like? Well, my media is like this. Maybe your media is a little better. I'll grant you that. You're probably moving in that direction. Mind control is real. It's your television. It's your internet, too. At least if you're not independent in your internet, you don't really do your own research. It's all about mind control. And in that reality, this doesn't exist. So, as dedicated and interested people involved in this phenomenon need to do, we need decent UFO investigative organizations. We need groups. In America, we got MUFON, but MUFON's really just not doing it. They need to conduct reliable investigations. Well, MUFON does sort of do that. But they need to follow up and educate the world. They need to create clear reports. They need to publicize their findings. And that's just the stars. Okay. Oh, also, internationally. And this was really brought home to me in the last 2 days. There's real opportunities for international collaboration now more than ever. There's Skype. There's Facebook. We can all talk to each other. We've got Google Translate now. We can really go to websites with languages that aren't our own language. We can build better relationships and start to really share information with each other around the world. But meanwhile, that's all like research stuff. Let's look at some of the bigger philosophical issues, some of the cosmological issues, where I think this field needs to be moving. Fundamentally, what are we dealing with, and where is this phenomenon going? Who the hell are these beings? What are these beings? Back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and even today, the ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, was a very, very popular. And again, I would say that there's a good reason for subscribing to that theory. But I try to remind myself, it's just a theory. It's not a religion. It's not a religion. There are other ways of looking at this. Even if they are or were from another planet, that doesn't really mean a whole lot, frankly. Because they seem to be here for the long term. And that's what's really interesting. Are they, shall we say, dimensional? Do we even know what that means? They go in and out of our dimensions. I mean, we hear this all the time, but it's, what does it mean scientifically? I don't know. But they do seem to have an ability to enter and leave our reality in certain ways. Are they a lost civilization? I wonder about this from time to time. Are they, in other words, human aliens? An ancient civilization that discovered some important secrets that just took them in a different direction, they decided not to share with the rest of us poor slobs, and they've gone into their own place. But then I wonder, if that's so, why are they secret? What do they have to fear from us? Questions and questions, not a lot of answers. Are they intelligent machines? I think that I was the first, at least American UFO researcher, or maybe the first UFO researcher, truly to explore this issue. Shortly after I became a public person in this field, I became very interested in exploring the idea of advanced artificial intelligence. And I do think that what we are dealing with has a relationship to hyper-advanced artificial intelligence in some way. Could be biological intelligence, could be machine intelligence. What's a machine? Anyway. Does a machine have to be inorganic? Can a machine be organic? It gets confusing. But I think genetically manipulated or technologically manipulated intelligence is very likely behind this. Are these beings what we would call angels and demons? Are they what we would call, do they time travel in some way? Some of them look like us. I'll tell you one story, maybe if I have time, I'll tell you two stories. One story, I spoke to a woman a couple of years ago, and her husband, she's about 60. And she told me a story about when she was a teenager in the 1960s, growing up in Western Pennsylvania. Western Pennsylvania is quite rural, lots of small towns. And in her town, everyone knew each other, especially in church. She was with her mother in church this one day. And she said, in the row in front of us were these two absolutely stunningly gorgeous men, male and female, blonde. They're like supernaturally beautiful. They had the most incredible blue clothing. She said it was the finest fabric she'd ever seen. And especially in that church, these people did not fit in. So she's a teenager, and she's looking at them just fascinated. And she can't think of anything else going on in church. And then to her shock, she hears them thinking in her mind. And what they're thinking is, how well are we fitting in here? People don't appear to be noticing us. That's good. And indeed, like in her opinion, like no one was noticing these two. She was shocked. She was like, why does anyone look at these two people? Am I the only one who's noticing them? And then she heard the woman think to the man, she can hear us. And at that moment, she was like a little bit nervous, but still fascinated. So, when the mass ended, those two got up and they were gone. They rushed out. Somehow they got ahead of the crowd and they were out of the church. And she decided she was going to pursue them. So she runs out. And her mother, oblivious, is screaming after her. Where are you going? Get back here. And she's going out. And she pushes ahead of the people. And she gets out of the church. And she sees this couple. And they're walking fast. They're across the parking lot. They're going up the hill. And they go over the hill. She can't see them. So she runs up the hill and she sees them. They're in like this clearing, it's all grass. And they're walking really fast to like a wooded area. So she's going down the hill. She's brave. She's like 14 years old. And then she stopped, dead in her tracks, because she saw another person. At the edge of the woods, she said to me that she saw this man. She said, if you've ever watched the TV show, The Addams Family, this guy was Lurch. If you remember, very tall, thin, kind of creepy looking. She said he was all in black, and he even had a black hat. And that intimidated her, and she stopped. And she watched these two blonde people, these two supermodels, walk up to the tall figure, go around him and into the woods. He turned around and went into the woods, and they were gone. And that's her story. There's no UFOs in the air, there's no landing UFOs. But you can see why it would be of interest. And I'll just tell you one other story that I got from a retired U.S. colonel, Air Force colonel, PhD. He's a PhD, very brilliant man. And I met with him and his wife. Now, you know, this colonel and this woman, they don't know each other at all. I met with him out west in the U.S. And he said, on one occasion, I was with my wife and a friend of ours, a female friend, who happened to be very psychic, at a Las Vegas casino hotel, one of the really nice ones. I think he said it was the Wynn, which is a very nice casino hotel. Anyway, we were up, he said, on the second floor, having fun, just like on a vacation. And the psychic friend grabbed his arm really tight. And she looked over in that direction, and there is this incredibly gorgeous blonde woman. Now, it's Las Vegas, so you get a lot of that. But this one was very unusual, apparently. The psychic friend said, she's not like us. And the friend and the wife went down an escalator. They were afraid. This colonel said, he stood there, and he's looking at this woman, and he feels her get into his head. And she says to him, in his mind, stop looking, none of your business, this has nothing to do with you, just get out. Or something like that. And he's like, what? So he doesn't leave, though. He stands there, and then he's watching, and she's joined, but there's this equally beautiful blonde male who's obviously with her, and they're now together. And they're walking toward the escalator, and he's in between them and the escalator. So he's thinking, I'm going to stop. I'm going to talk to them. So he's getting up the courage. He's an Air Force colonel. You think he's kind of brave? I don't know. But he doesn't do anything. They walk right by him. But then he gets behind him, and they go down the escalator. And all the way down the escalator, he's hearing them think, he says to me. And they're thinking, he has no need to know. He's not part of any of this. Ignore him, etc., etc. And meanwhile, his wife and the friend are peeking behind one of the slot machines like this. And in fact, when he told that story, the wife started laughing. That's so true, we were doing that. And they get to the bottom of the escalator, and the two blonde people just walk off, and no one stops them. So again, another crazy story. I mean, who are these people? We talk about human and alien hybrids, but these people look a lot more human than any hybrid that I've ever heard of. And they seem like they're living here. So what are they doing? Maybe they're not all blonde, I don't know. But there are stories like this, I feel. I mean, this is part of what we're dealing with. They're not UFOs, but we've got to understand what this is. Because the phenomenon is not just about objects in the sky. It's about things going on right down here on the ground on our planet. Here's a couple of things I can confidently say to you that based on everything that I've looked at, this is what I think. They're telepathic. They're intensely telepathic. And not just the human-looking ones. You get the stories of the Greys and the abductions. And every one of those says the same thing. This entity comes up, gets right in their face, and they, like, read my mind. I believe that there's mind-machine connections that these beings have. I believe they can manipulate space-time in ways that we don't quite understand. I believe they can manage your memory. They can take you, do whatever. They prevent you from forming memories to a greater or lesser extent. They can give you screen memories, fake memories. I think that they're also bioengineered. I don't think that they're just naturally occurring. I think they've been genetically modified to do what they do. So here's a scenario. I would just encourage you to think about this. So we'll start off with three groups. There's us, that's all of us, unless any of you are any aliens in there, so then you would be in the them group. And if any of you are in the breakaway civilization that I talked about, you would be there. But you got the three basic groups, but it's just not that simple. Because there, I think, at least I would hypothesize that there might be more than one group of them. Why do I think that, incidentally? Well, think about where we as, first of all, look at the stories that have come down. You've got a range of beings that people talk about. But also, it's my opinion that humanity is of prime importance right now. Right now. We've gone for thousands of years, basically, with animals pulling wooden carts. That was our civilization. And suddenly, in 100 years, we go, we're up like a rocket with integrated circuits, computers, iPhones and everything else, and we're obviously not standing still. So where are we going to be another 10, 20, 30 years? We're going to be leaping into their world. That's what we're going to do. So anybody who's got the ability to look at us has got to be looking at us right now. So I think there's multiple groups of them. Then you've got, at least this is my opinion, I don't think there's simply one classified group. But the global intelligence community competes. You've got factions. I think that this is the case with groups that have interest in UFO technology, and I will just say this one thing to you. I have had correspondence with a few individuals that I think could be part of that group. I have. And I don't know that they've been telling me the truth, but I have correspondence from them. I'm trying to figure out what I do with this correspondence, if anything. I do get the idea that there may be more than one group that they compete, and it would make sense to me. Because there's a tremendous prize here. The prize is science, the prize is power. Control over the knowledge, control over the technology. And then there's us. We're not unified. We have different belief systems. And all of this is being played out on our planet. And I also think that you've got merging alliances and shifting alliances so much so that it's a little confusing, maybe. I would like to have a scorecard, like if it's a sporting event, so I know what the numbers the players have, but it's not that simple. So that's, I think, what we're dealing with. I'm getting toward the home stretch of this. And by the way, when I'm done, hopefully we can have some time for questions and answers, which I'd be very happy to do. There's the issue of abduction and contact. And I list them separately. And you can see from these images, you'll get the idea. On your left side, the creepy, ominous, frightening specter of creepy-looking aliens taking people and doing things to them. What do they do to them? Well, that's a very good question. I think one thing they do to them is they take their genetic material, they mine them of genetic material, often for an entire lifetime, often their children as well, because it does go through the bloodline, it seems to. They're not necessarily evil. I mean, you don't get a whole many stories of people claiming to have been tortured by these beings. But they also don't seem like they'd be very fun to have, go out and have a beer with either, so they're not really fun. And then you have claims on the other side of people who have telepathic connection. I'm not just talking about channels, that's a different thing altogether. But people who, especially, you get this a lot when people meditate. I've encountered it a lot. They are adamant. They will have telepathic communication with beings that are not human. So those are two distinct elements of what we're dealing with. As far as abductions, it is necessary, I think, for us to come to terms with what is happening regarding these abductions. Are they really happening? Not every researcher actually believes that abductions are happening. I happen to believe, I've been looking into a number of abduction cases privately, I will write a book on this. I think they are happening. Who's doing the abductions? Are the abductors all aliens, or are there human abductions? Well, let me just say to you, there are definitely military abductions. There are definitely, if they're not military, let's call them black budget abductions. They're done by humans who have military connections, but they may not be working for the military. Yes, they may be working for a deeply classified private clandestine organization. Why would they take you? I'll get into that in a moment. Do we know when abduction started? Do we know how important hybridization is? Are they creating new species, in other words? Are there other reasons that people might be abducted? The answer is yes, there are. To what extent do people live secret lives? I'll tell you one case that I've looked at quite a bit, of a person who has intensely gifted psychic abilities. This is not a unique case, I'm convinced. This is a person who's been taken, is a woman. She's been taken her whole adult life, and even as a child. She's been targeted because somehow there are groups, human and non-group human, who know of her abilities, and she's valuable. And they take her and they use her. I believe this happens frequently enough. So they don't just take you to mine you of your genetic material, although they have taken her genetic material. I think they have used her to make babies. But they also use her to work. Remote viewing, looking through time, streams, and whatnot. Now that's what it looks like to me. I think it's actually happening. Great reason. So that there are certain people who are of prime interest to multiple groups, human and non-human. And when they get taken, you can't take them consciously because they might become a security risk. They might not agree to do it. They might become a problem in various ways. So you take them, you might even be nice to them. You take them in the middle of the night, you give them an injection, you can prevent them from forming fresh memories most of the time. You take them for 3 hours, 4 hours, you put them to work, you bring them back with your magical technology. And the next, all they know is the next morning they wake up a little late, a little groggy, wondering why they're so tired. And I think this happens. Now, it's really not all that different from the traditional abduction scenario that other researchers in the past have talked about. It's a little more creepy. So my question is, to what extent do people have such lives? Are the abduction phenomenon an assault on humanity, or is it an opportunity for us to grow? And by, let me explain, you know, the late Harvard psychiatrist Dr. John Mack liked to point out that although abductions seem traumatic to people who went through the experiences, he felt that people often exhibited signs of personal growth as a result. They become more aware of the world, of the world, the global ecosystem, of higher consciousness issues, and so forth. So it was his supposition that abductions had, you know, did have this positive effect. He says, look, if you're really ever going to have personal growth, you can't just do the same thing you've done over and over again anyway. You can't stay at your own comfort level. You do have to be challenged. That's true. And abductions do that. So, are the ETs or the aliens behind that? Bud Hopkins, who didn't agree with that, pointed out to John Mack, he said, well, that's true, but who's actually helping these people become enlightened, John? The ETs or you in bringing them through the process? And that is a good counterpoint. So the question is, what is actually going on with these abductions? I'll tell you one thing, if this secret ever comes out, there will be some very significant political implications. It's not that our political leaders would be able to stop it from happening, but that's one of the problems right there. It's a lack of control. Now we're talking about contact a little bit. That is, intentional telepathic contact with these other beings. It has a pretty long history, actually. 18th century philosopher Emanuel Swedenborg. I'm sure many people in the room here know about him. Claimed to have had such contact with extraterrestrial beings. Yes, he did. In the 19th century, Helena Blavatsky, really the creator, I would say, one of the prime creators of what we call New Age movement, certainly claimed that. Aleister Crowley, who after ingesting opium and having ritualistic sex and smoking a lot of dope and then meditating, would see an alien entity that he called Wham. And there's a drawing of Wham. He's got this big head. He looks kind of like a grape, a little bit. Alice Bailey, an American, did a lot of channeling. All of these people in the, you know, years past claimed to be in touch with extraterrestrials. In the 1950s, we get all of the contactee books who claimed a different type of contact with extraterrestrials. And then it develops into, more recently, we have a lot of channelers. There's Basha Darolinka, there's Ashtar Command, there's Jay-Z Knight, there's Zeta Talk, and there's many others who claim to have messages from extraterrestrials. In Jay-Z Knight's case, Ramtha is Lemurian, not extraterrestrial, but nonetheless. I don't know if I have an opinion on channeling. My problem with it, of course, is that I can't easily test it. My problem is that I would love for a channeler to give some kind of scientific information or solve a mathematical problem that would prove to me that this is actually from intelligence that is independent of the person in some way. But I will say this. I have a friend who is close with Daryl Anka, and she swears by him. And I like her, and I think I trust her. She says he's absolutely legitimate. What can I say? I suppose I would say that I'm a believer in remote viewing. I've spoken to a lot of remote viewers. I think that's for real. I don't doubt that something like this could be possible. My problem is simply, if you were to listen to all the channelers, you'd be really confused. And then go back, you know, in America, we had Jane Roberts in the 1960s and 70s, and you take all of these channelers, and they're giving a very different kind of cosmology than that is. So it's difficult to know what is true. For me, the real question is about, we call them CE5, that is intentional contact with other entities. The real question is not is there a mind-to-mind link between us and them, because I think that is the case. But how does it work? How can we demonstrate it in some scientifically satisfactory way? How can it be replicated? There's a philosophical divide in this field. It's really an old philosophical divide. It's not just related to UFOs. It goes back thousands of years. You can call it religion versus science. You can call it subjectivism versus objectivism, spiritualism versus materialism. The idea being, is reality one or is it more than one? Remember, you know the great painting by Raphael, The School of Athens? I had it as my desktop. I've had it for a while, but I love that painting. So in the center of the painting, you have Aristotle and Plato, and they're walking. Plato's pointing up, and Aristotle's pointing down. And there's a lot of other great symbolism in this painting. But really, it expresses a fundamental difference of philosophy. Plato, of course, talked about a reality beyond what we could perceive, that this physical reality is basically an illusion. Aristotle didn't see it that way and said, really, our reality is what we can perceive. And that's a divide that has gone through human history. And we see it in this field of ours, UFOs. In the sense of people who have claimed that there's a profound spiritual component to this subject, which I happen to believe. I guess I feel like I'm right in between Plato and Aristotle. I think that there is a spiritual element to this. I do happen to believe that when this body of mine dies, there'll be a part of me that goes somewhere. I don't know what that will be. But I believe in what we call non-locality. I think that science is starting to move in that direction anyway. But the problem is, we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with knowledge that is subjective versus objective. In other words, knowledge is based on just trust me, because it happened, and I feel that it's true, and it's my truth. That to me, I have to confess to you, I've not ever been comfortable with. On the other hand, the problem is that there's this mind component to what we're dealing with. How do we test it? How do we confirm it scientifically? See, there's the problem. Not sure I have that figured out. I talked a little bit about some of the things I've looked into. I mentioned that my own investigations into abductions and encounters has affected many people, not just a few, who have psychic capabilities. I do believe that they are of interest. There's symbolism involved in this field. Old-fashioned ufology would never want to look at this. I cannot tell you how many people that I have interviewed who've had strange experiences who have woken up in the middle of the night at 3:33 a.m. again and again and again, after they had something really crazy happen. What does it mean? I don't know. It seems to be having some symbolic significance. I'd like to know what it means. I think that there is a shadowy human group that's monitoring this whole process, and especially what we call special children, special people. These people with psychic capabilities, I think. So my bottom line is that there are multiple groups, human and non-human, that are monitoring certain people throughout their lives. Now, I've often described disclosure as the end of secrecy. It's a paradox. It's impossible, but it's inevitable. It really is both of these things. It's impossible because when you really think about the people who've got all of this information, I mean, how could they ever possibly want to tell us? They have so much to lose. So they have no motivation, as I see. But it's inevitable. Why is it inevitable? Because they're not the only factor in the secrecy equation. There is us. We are changing as a society so dramatically. We're reinventing ourselves, not just as a civilization, but probably as a species. And in the next 50-100 years, what are we even going to look like? Really, what are we going to look like? We've mastered the human genome. Do you really think that someone's going to refrain from playing around with our genetic material or putting little nanochips in our brains, make us a little smarter? wireless connection to the web, our brain to the web? I mean, honestly, who knows? In that kind of a world, do we really think we're not going to be any farther along in understanding this than we are today? Change is unstoppable. Our technologies are almost impossible to understand. It's always been impossible to foresee the future. If you've ever read H.G. Wells' great book, War of the Worlds, I mean, H.G. Wells was one of the most visionary writers of his time. He writes War of the Worlds in 1897. Okay, so men from Mars come to Earth to take over, and what are the craft that they use to take over? They get these craft that walk around on three legs. They don't fly. They don't fly. And he was only less than a decade away from the Wright brothers inventing the airplane. And H.G. Wells, with his incredibly great imagination, did not conceive a flying machine in that book, because the future is so difficult to imagine. The American writer Edgar Allan Poe, a few years earlier, wrote a futuristic story. He wrote it in the year 1848. And the story took place 1,000 years into the future. So, 2848. And the story is a series of letters written by this one character who's traveling around the world in the most advanced form of transportation that humanity has achieved, which is high-speed, high-altitude balloon travel at about 100 miles an hour, maybe. That's in 1,000 years. And Edgar Allan Poe had a really good imagination. So we can't imagine. I think that the reality outstrips our ability to conceive what's going to happen. I mean, I wouldn't even try to begin to imagine 100 years from now, but I think we are really on the fast track. Really on the fast track. I think in our future, we're going to see the moment where this secret comes out, where it's forced out. It's not going to come out voluntarily. And of course, when it does, there's going to be spin control galore. The CIA is not just going to walk away from the table simply because it's out. They're going to want to control knowledge as much as possible. But the issue will be, will they succeed? See, the moment of disclosure, as I argue, is not the moment of where we get all the truth. That's the beginning of the actual battle for truth. That's when it actually, we take off the gloves and we really do it. And as a result of disclosure, I do believe it will bring forth many significant changes globally, geopolitically, technologically, scientifically, culturally, religious and spiritual changes, all of these. I wrote about this along with my co-author, Brian Zabel, in AD After Disclosure. I was going to bring copies of the book, but my airline said they wouldn't allow me to take boxes on the airplane. Had I put them in a suitcase, I would have been in one. Didn't know. Anyway, that's what we wrote about. One thing to consider is, will the future outing of this secret, if we get to that point, elicit a change in any of the beings or others that may be monitoring us? Will they embrace us as members of the galactic community? Will they be hostile? Or will they continue to be aloof? I don't know. And I'm just putting it out there. I'm just about done here. I guess I'm a very ironic person. You can't be a thinking person in America without appreciating irony. I'm very ironic. I think that there will be a moment of irony once we get to a moment of truth or openness on this topic. One of the moments of irony might be that the secret keepers are probably not on top of this scenario either. In other words, they may not be up to the job of dealing with this, the challenge of these other entities here on planet Earth. And I will tell you one more anecdote that I got from another very, very prominent American researcher who's gone through a long journey in this field as well. He said to me that this researcher had an interview with a retired member of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, who said that for 20 years his job was to monitor, as he put it, the three primary extraterrestrial races that we hear on planet Earth. They were the Nordic slash blondes, as they're sometimes called, because they're tall and blonde. They were the Greys, or as he called it, the Evens, extraterrestrial biological entities. One group had a primary base under the ocean floor, another group had a base in the Himalayas, and then the third race were reptilian type entities. He called them standing up crocodiles. Is it true? And in fact, one thing he said to this person was that the crocodiles initially came as the police, but then all of these groups devolved into factions, and all of them felt that humanity was the prize. How are we the prize? He didn't say. Is it true? I don't know if it's true. After we get to a point where we are able to force the secret out, will we even end up knowing any of these truths? Or will we just continue arguing about it forever and ever? That's the irony, which is that disclosure really may not solve a lot of our questions. It may solve some, and it may open up many others. So it could take years. A century from now, here's one thing I will say, I think confidently, that I mean I'm an idealist, I admit that, but I'm not a utopian. And I do not believe that ending the secrecy, getting disclosure, is going to solve every single problem we have. Even if that includes free energy, which, you know, many people want. But I'll tell you, we had free energy once upon a time. It was called petroleum, and it was pretty much free. And we carved up the world for it, and we killed a lot of people over it. Now, admittedly, free, clean energy might be a lot nicer. But human beings, unless we truly all become something other than human, then we're still going to have emotions, we're still going to have passions, and we're still going to have greed, it seems to me. And if you get free energy, like something that will heat your home forever for free, let's say, wouldn't that be nice? Do you really think that there might not be someone else in the world who would be able to take that breakthrough and weaponize it and use it to blow up the Pacific Ocean just because he's crazy? I mean, look, there are people like that. So the question will be, will such a technological bonanza be a good thing for us? Or will we have to figure out a way to manage it so that we really don't kill each other? I don't know. I do think human society in a century from now will seem alien to us. Imagine, someone 200 years ago, like Ludwig von Beethoven. Take him from 200 years ago, drop him in our society, and give him hearing so he could hear everything. I mean, he wouldn't recognize us. We would be like this insane society. Or a monk from 1,000 years earlier to hear Beethoven's music, they would think the same thing, my God. So, us a century from now, I really don't think we'll be able to recognize our society. I think our species, there may not be any more good, old-fashioned, unenhanced Homo sapiens. We may all be enhanced in one way or another. I do think that as our society in a century will have an open acknowledgement of these other beings. And I think some of our current questions will be answered, but I have to think that there are going to be new questions and challenges and problems that our society is going to have to deal with. But the thing about the UFO topic is that it's one way that by exploring this, at least for me, it has been the most amazing journey of these last two decades. I was on a certain path. I wanted to teach history at a university. That's what I wanted. And then I got hooked onto this field, and it just took me into this whole other path. And I left the academic world, and I don't make as much money as I think I probably could have, and that's too bad. But on the other hand, I'm in a field that I have to say has been the most fascinating journey that I could possibly imagine. And that's the great thing about UFOs, and that's why it is not silly. That's why it is actually the most fascinating topic that I personally can think of. And so the next time you are in a situation where you have a skeptical friend who wants to laugh at you, you might be able to reply with a couple of really good rejoinders to explain why this actually is important. This is my website, keyholepublishing.com. I also share the website afterdisclosure.com. Those are three of my books. I am finishing, I actually have finished a draft of this book. I think that's going to be the title, UFOs of the 21st Century Mind. A lot of the themes that I've discussed here with you are in that book, and it'll certainly be out before the end of the year. And I know I have gone way over my allotted time. I would definitely like to thank you for your patience and thank you for being here. Thank you very much.
First of all, Richard, I have to say thank you so much for a great lecture. And I know that there are a lot of questions, but I would suggest that we take like a 5-10 minute break so that people can go to, stretch the legs, go to the toilet, etc. And then we'll get back to the questions.
Great. I look forward to it.